The Run Your Own Server podcast for August the 25th, 2006.
Here's a little song about caffeine. Poets like caffeine. Politicians like caffeine. Beatniks like caffeine. Everybody likes caffeine. I like caffeine. I like caffeine. Up when everything has got you down. Sometimes you get sleepy when the caffeine can't be found. I like caffeine.
In this episode, hardware, CPUs, RAM, motherboards, hard drives, RAID, network cards, moment of sack, and bobbing for hamsters.
Christians like caffeine. Everybody likes caffeine. I like caffeine.
This episode's reverse sponsor is Socris. Socris Engineering, Inc. is a small company specializing in the design of embedded computer and communication devices. If you want a small server with low power requirements, this is the place to go. Check them out at Socris.com. That's Soekris.com.
And now the last verse. Bogart likes caffeine. Bob Hope likes caffeine. Ruth Fuzzy likes caffeine.
Okay, to start off this episode, we want to take care of some housekeeping. The first thing is we want to apologize for not being regular with the release of our episodes. It's been nearly a month since we recorded the last one. And personally, I have to say that I'm really sorry we can't do this more often. We really have only gotten started, and we've already got quite a few subscribers. I just want to apologize to everybody. Hope you guys stay subscribed and keep listening. But then on the flip side of that, you have to understand that we're real sysadmins. So from time to time, we have bad weeks, and in this case, a bad month, where there's just so many fires that we have to fight and so many customers that we have to try to make happy that by the time we have a free moment, we generally doze off instead of recording a podcast.
It's not something that we will make a habit of. We do want to try and get the show out once a week, but it's really hard when there's two of us. I might be putting out fires and be fine to record one week, and Thud, you know, it's just too hard for both of us to make sure we have time. But this past month was crazy, so hopefully it won't be as bad in the future.
All right, and the next little bit of housekeeping we want to do is take care of our first audio question. Our first real audio question is from Binary Alcove. He's currently living on the internet, like a bunch of people. So here's his question.
Hey guys, I have a couple of questions for you. The first one is about backups. Right now I have a Fedora Core 4 box, and I'm running a cron job that copies one disk to the other. And I mean, it's working out okay, but I'm pretty sure you know something better. My second question is about desktop management. If I need the rundown on that one, you know, a good server operating system for it, and what kind of technologies to do it with. Any help you'll give, it would be great. You know, I love your show and all that good stuff, so keep them coming. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, so the first part of his question was about backups. Oddly enough, that's what we're planning for our next episode, so we'll get into some extreme detail with that. But just generally, Gek, give us some general pointers for backups.
Backups are actually what I do where I work. It's one of my main tasks. And if you can't afford backup software like NetBackup, and most people can't, the best thing, I use rsync or tar to do some sort of script magic where I copy like a full backup, and then I do incremental tars, or for the stuff that I rsync, I just rsync everything to one disk, and then I do tars of the parts of that disk that I care about. We will go into backups in a lot more detail in the next episode. And to answer your question real quick, what I like to use instead of just copying files, rsync is really nice. There's a lot of switches you can use to synchronize two disks You can even exclude certain subdirectories, which is something I do. There's a lot of pictures that I've collected from clip art sites on the web, and I don't necessarily need to back those up. I can just exclude them from my rsync. I don't care if I lose them. And you know, tar is the other one. I mean, tar is, it's tried and true, and it works great. I mean, you can compress things, you can do incrementals, you can do differentials, so it's great for doing backups.
Yeah, actually, most of the backup systems I've set up, we're using tar in some form or another, just because it's easy to do. It doesn't mean you have to have at least twice as much disk space, you know, so because the original tar is going to be exactly the same size as the system you're backing up, and from there you can compress it, which takes additional disk space. But I think the most important point to make now is that you want to get the backups off of the server. Copying it over to another hard drive is good, and in a lot of cases is a really the fastest way to do it, and it's also the fastest way to restore. So if you do have an issue where a file gets overwritten or something, the backup is right there on the drive ready to restore. But for safety's sake, you need to get it off the server. Some people use tape. Some people just have a dedicated backup server or a file server they just dump it on. There's a lot of ways you can do that. Rsync you can actually do over the network, or you can use FTP, or you can even do it with SSH. But it's important to get it off of the server, because if you have a crash or your server gets hacked into, or there's a virus or something, it could wipe out everything, including your backups. By having it off the server, there's less chance of an issue with the first server affecting the backups on the second server.
For a disk-to-disk backup, that solution works fine as long as the second disk is a USB disk, and when you're done doing the backup, you remove it from the system. What THUD is trying to protect you from, aside from just hackers, is if you have some kind of a power surge that takes out your box, you don't want it taking out the backup hard drive as well.
Exactly. And USB works well. What about the second part of his question?
That's a tough one. It depends. I haven't done desktop support in a long time, and if you're supporting an environment that's going to be Windows machines, I would almost say that you have to have a domain and use group policy, just because that's the best tool for the job that I've ever seen. With Nix solutions, with a Linux solution, it's actually a lot easier. There's a lot of different programs out there. CF Engine is one that I've heard mentioned a lot. I've actually never used it, and I am working on my own configuration program that'll push out configuration changes to servers. But it's been a long time since I dealt with configuring lots of workstations.
Yeah, I would say I'm pretty much the same way. Most of what I do day-to-day is server-related. For workstations, it really depends on a number of things. What the OS is for the workstations, and the number of workstations are the two major things. If they are Windows, there's lots of Windows tools out there for managing them. Unfortunately, they all cost money. If they're Unix workstations, if there's not a large number of them, you can just SSH into the boxes and upload patches and install them and do all of that good stuff all from the command line. If you go with something commercial like a Red Hat, for example, Red Hat has a Red Hat subscription that can take care of doing patches and stuff like that. There's a lot of things that you can do, but it really depends on what your particular environment is.
Also with Red Hat, one of the things that would make the life of sysadmin easier for doing desktops is Kickstart. I mean, if you set up a Kickstart image, then you can basically kickstart the workstations, you know, 95% of the where you need them to be, and that helps so that you're not sitting there, you know, tweaking this or that. You just change your Kickstart image, and every time you build the machine, it's what your current image is supposed to be.
Yeah, Kickstart is great. Windows has something similar called Riz that allows you to build systems automatically. It's actually kind of funny that you mention it, because I have a friend who emailed me last weekend, and what they've decided to do at their office, which is about 20 machines, is every weekend he has an automated job that kickstarts all of the workstations back to their default system. because he was having so many problems with users changing all the settings, installing their own software or whatever, that he just decided it was easier to manage that way. He got management to approve doing it that way, and the first weekend, the first Monday after a reinstall, was very happy for most of the people in his office, because suddenly all of their pictures were gone and all their email was gone, even though he told them don't store it there, store it on the server. You know how users can be. They can be quite deaf sometimes. So we'd like to thank Binary Alcove for his question, and encourage anybody out there who has other questions for us. You can either send it in an email to podcast@runyourownserver.org, or just send us an MP3 file with your recording, and we'll play it on the air. And if we play it on the air, we'll reward you this over the next few episodes by trying not to get your name wrong. All right, so let's jump right into the hardware show and talk about one of the more important things in a server, the CPU. Gek, tell us why you need a decent CPU for a server.
Well, it kind of depends on what you're trying to do with the box, but for most servers, you are trying to run an application, whether it's a database, a mail server, or in my case, I have a fractal rendering server. You want something that's got a really good CPU because you want it to process whatever's thrown at it and move on to the next thing. You don't want your CPU generally to be at 100% all the time. That's a really good indicator that you need a bigger box. And it's not something that you want to run into a year or two after you put the box in place. Generally, you want to try and make your server so that it's designed to handle whatever your load's going to be. I usually go for like the next 3 years.
There's two big manufacturers for processors, Intel and AMD. What's your experience as far as differences go?
Well, I haven't used AMDs much, but I know a lot of people who do. And it used to be that AMDs had a serious overheating problem and the CPUs were kind of fragile. I've heard that's not the case anymore, and the benchmarks that I've seen for AMD look really, really promising. Price-wise, AMD is much cheaper than Intel. But I have always been an Intel guy just because that's what I know and that's what I'm comfortable with. How about you? Have you ever used AMD?
Yeah, there's actually been a few projects where I've used AMD, but I've also had a lot of friends that were into gaming quite a bit that for a long time just everything was AMD because you got better price for the punch that you were getting out of the processor. Again, they were having a lot of problem with heat and keeping the processor cool. But I've always been kind of the same way. The way I've looked at it is, they're Intel processors. AMDs are always trying to emulate them. AMD did have the 64-bit processors really out on the market before Intel did. But I've always been an Intel guy. Even for the motherboards, I buy an Intel processor and an Intel motherboard if I can afford to do it. Everything just seems to run better that way. Okay, one of the things that comes up when talking about processors is speed. Is there really any difference between a 2.4 gigahertz and a 3 gigahertz for most things performance-wise?
In my experience, you don't get a big performance hike in just gigahertz or megahertz. It seems to be more when you jump from one family to another, although with the AMDs, it's a little more confusing to me because they haven't done like a numbering scheme for their versions. They seem to be doing like naming schemes, and that, for me, that's harder to follow if I'm not sitting there reading AMD's page every day. I haven't seen a big difference going from a 2.4 gigahertz processor to, 3 gigahertz processor, but I did see a huge jump when I went from, say, Pentium 3 to Pentium 4. And for what I do with fractals, I mean, it's something I can measure in hours. It saves me a lot of time to have a processor that's a different generation. But the megahertz, gigahertz really hasn't been that big of an impact on rendering my fractals.
What about L2 or level 2 cache?
I know for a lot of things it does speed things up, but I haven't had a lot of experience with chips that had more than half a meg. So have you ever used anything? I know they come in a meg and 2 meg caches, and I've never used them.
Yeah, it actually does help quite a bit, especially if you're doing repetitive tasks where you're running more or less the same calculation over and over again, because the processor can kind of cache the response. I ran it 10 minutes ago, and this is what the answer was. So there's no point in me running it again. It's the same answer. So the bigger L2 cache, the more things you can cache and the longer you can cache them for. So it really depends. I mean, if gaming, for example, would probably benefit quite a bit from L2 because you're doing the same calculations. If you're in the same room, you're running the same calculations to render all the polygons properly. But if you're doing fractals, for example, every calculation is going to have a different answer. It's not going to have a chance to cache anything. So it does make a difference depending on what you're doing. So what about multiple processors? Does adding a second processor really make any difference for most tasks?
If your task is going to be an application or multiple applications, then it usually does. But if what you're doing is really more hard drive intensive, like if you're just using the server as a file server, multiple CPUs isn't going to be a huge benefit. I haven't actually used multiple CPUs for many of my servers. I think you've done more with multiple processor systems than I have.
Yeah, on the high-end systems, it comes in really handy for one of the things you talked about, so that you could actually have a system that's up more simply because one of the processors dies, but it can still use the other one. So you have a much higher availability with that. And depending on what you're doing, if you're doing a lot of transactions, like a big mail server that's not just doing mail by itself, but it's also doing antivirus or anti-spam, things like that, those can all be pretty processor intensive. And most OSs can, even if the program itself can't handle multiprocessor, most OSs will allow forks of software. So as an example, an email comes in, it processes through the mail server, and then the mail server decides to check it for viruses. So it forks off a process for that. It can do that on one of the available processors. It can do that, come back, and now it wants to check it for antivirus, it can put it off on another processor. So that's really where it comes in handy. If you're doing things that are processor intensive and can be broken easily into chunks, then multiprocessor helps. Otherwise, it doesn't. Most of the servers that I run for my own stuff are single processors. It's just cheaper that way. And when it does come time to upgrade, I'll probably go with a dual core processor. So I've still got one physical processor, but it works like two, just because, you know, in a year's time, that's going to be the default. You're not going to be able to get just a single core processor anymore.
I will say, hyper-threading, which makes a CPU look like it's two CPUs, I was never a big fan of. And one of the reasons was when I was running my fractals, I could see a huge difference. If I turn hyper-threading on, it was actually slower because you're making the processor weaker than if you just leave it as a single processor. I don't think hyper-threading is a good idea for servers, generally speaking. There certainly would be situations where it would make sense. But in my experience, you don't run it like a virtual CPU. There are two virtual CPUs. You would just want to run it, if you had a dual core, like you were saying, run it so that you have one physical CPU, but it's two processors on the same board.
Yeah, hyper-threading was at least on the server side of the market, was a pretty big disappointment. It didn't provide nearly the performance that Intel had expected it to. It's one of the reasons why the dual cores finally came around and they're phasing out hyper-threading altogether. Let's go ahead and move on to motherboards. Gek, what do you look for when you're buying a new motherboard for a server?
Basically, I just ask myself what I'm going to use the server for, and most of the time what that means is I'm going to go find an entry-level server board from Intel. And my base board that I like has video and network onboard. I don't usually do much in the way of RAID because I'm pretty good about backing stuff up, and I don't mind downtime for any of the stuff that I'm doing. For customers, that's certainly not the case. For customers, I will get RAID, but I don't usually go with RAID on the motherboard. I'll get a RAID controller. Thud, what do you look for? What do you consider important features in a motherboard?
It really depends on what I'm doing. As I said earlier, the first one is it has to be made by Intel. Intel is just the, as far as I've ever had experience with, Intel has the most stable motherboards. They don't have all the greatest features. They're not always the fastest motherboards, but Intel motherboards I've never had an issue with. Even doing like BIOS upgrades and things like that, I've never had an issue with them. I've had Asus motherboards that I've killed while doing a BIOS upgrade, because it just decided to wipe it out instead of upgrade it. So that's the first thing I look for. It has to be made by Intel. And then from there, it just depends on what I'm doing. If I'm building a file server, I don't need multiple processors, so I'll go one processor. I probably won't need a lot of RAM, so I won't even look to see what the maximum amount of RAM is. Everything these days is 2 or 4 gigs. That's more than enough. But if I'm doing something that's business critical and requires a lot of uptime, I'm going to look for all the high availability things. I'm going to look for as many processors as I can put in it. I'm going to make sure that even if I can't afford to buy all the processors, like it's a 4-processor box, but I can only afford to put 2 in, at least later on down the road I can upgrade, I can add more power to it. Same thing with the RAM. I may only need 4 gigs of RAM now, but it's nice to know if I need to, that I could upgrade to 16, so that's what I look for. I look for a board with 16. And I'm kind of like you. I don't really like onboard controllers, so I don't care if the motherboard has SCSI RAID or SATA RAID or whatever. I'm really concerned about, does it have the number of slots I need to add the cards that I want? Because I've always had better luck with add-on cards, besides the fact that it lets me pick exactly the card I want with the features I want. So now that I've said that Intel is my favorite brand, do you have any favorite brands, Gek?
I usually stick with Intel. I have in the past picked up Asus and A-Bit boards, and I didn't really have any big issues with them. I think I did have a couple issues with an MSI board that I got, but I just, like you said, Intel's pretty reliable. It's easy to work with, and I feel like they make the chips. It makes sense to use their motherboard.
Yeah, that's kind of my thinking as well. Okay, when it comes to memory, it depends on what kind of processor you get and what kind of motherboard you get as to what they require. So it's good to have an idea once you've picked out your processor and motherboard to see what the motherboard is capable of using as far as memory goes, ECC or non-ECC or what have you. But just in general terms, what's the main difference between ECC and non-ECC?
Well, the way I understand it, ECC is, it's more expensive because there's parity built into it. So where on a regular memory chip, you may have one of the little memory chips on it go bad. ECC will recover from that, where regular memory may not, and that's sometimes why you get system lockups. Beyond that, I've only worked with ECC on very few servers. Do you have experience with ECC?
The possibility of having a memory error and then crashing a server isn't really outweighed that much by the expense of ECC. There are a few situations, like if you have one big file server, where it makes sense to spend the extra money and get ECC. But for the most part, it really doesn't matter. It's not worth the extra expense.
Do you have a favorite brand of memory that you use?
For the most part, I go with Crucial. There are a couple on the high-end side, like if I were going to spend the money on ECC, there are a couple of other companies. It really depends on who has the cheapest price at the time, but I've always had really good luck with Crucial, and the one thing I like about Crucial is all memory has a particular speed, and for the last however many years, you've also had to worry about heat coming off of the memory, just adding to the general heat within a case. And I've always found that Crucial is always, they actually run faster than the speed that they're spec'd at, and the heat is always much lower than most of the other memory manufacturers.
Yeah, I've used Crucial, I think, for the past 4 or 5 years, and I have never had one of their chips go bad on me before I replaced it to upgrade or replace the machine. I've had really good luck with them. When you're building a server thud, the next thing you really want to think about is hard drives. Do you usually choose SCSI or SATA?
It really depends. It really depends on what I'm doing with a particular server. It used to depend on whether or not I was going to use RAID. The SCSI RAID cards have always been, well, until recently, much better performance and feature-wise than the SATA RAID cards. They've also been a whole lot more expensive. In the last couple of years, I've found a really good RAID card manufacturer for SATA drives. It's 3Ware is the manufacturer. I really love the RAID cards. I don't see any reason anymore to go SCSI unless you're going extreme high-end. And SCSI is still more expensive. If you're talking like a 80 gig drive, there's not a whole lot of price difference. But a 140 gig drive or a 300 gig for SCSI is much, much more expensive than the same size drive in SATA. But other than that, there really isn't, from a technical standpoint, there isn't a whole lot of difference.
What about speed? I know when you're talking about speed on a hard drive, there's a few different things that matter. The RPMs and then the throughput on your controller, you know, whether it's SCSI or SATA. What do you usually choose? How do you go about determining what kind of speed you need and what are the differences?
Well, what it comes down to is where the hard drive is going to sit in the operating system. I tend to choose, especially on servers, I tend to choose fast hard drives for the boot drive. It just makes the, when you have to reboot a server, it makes the process a whole lot faster because it can pull the data off of the drive a lot faster. So for the SATA drives, for example, I tend to use the Western Digital Raptors, which are 10,000 RPM. For data drives, it doesn't really matter that much because generally by the time the OS is loaded, the drives can cache, the system can cache. So pulling data off of a data drive isn't nearly as important, and it also saves some money. The faster drives are more expensive, and there's also size limits. I think the biggest 10,000 RPM SATA drive that I know of is only 150 gigs, but Seagate has 750 gigabyte SATA drives now. So they're not 10,000 RPM, but they can hold a lot of storage, and in certain environments, that's what you're after. You want more space over more speed. Just depends on what you're doing. Like most of the hardware, you have to kind of cater what you're designing to what your end goal is. You don't want to just have a standard that you use on everything. You'll end up wasting a lot of money that way. Okay, let's talk about troubleshooting hard drives. Gek, do you have any tips for troubleshooting hard drive problems?
When it comes to hard drives, it can be really tricky. A lot of the problems can manifest the same symptoms as other things, like a bad CPU or bad memory. Really, you got to look for, are files getting corrupted? Sometimes you'll know, it'll be obvious, because you'll hear the little heads on the hard drive clunking around, and then you know it's just time to toss it. But I have not had a lot of luck with software tools and trying to do diagnostics on hard drives. Have you ever had luck with, like, DD or anything helping you diagnose a bad drive?
Well, it really depends. On SCSI drives, there's usually built in to the hardware of the SCSI subsystem the ability to detect hard drive errors. So that it makes it a lot easier to figure out exactly, you know, if it is a hard drive problem or if it's something else. On SATA drives, it's a little bit more difficult because not all SATA drives fully support SMART and not all controllers fully support SMART. So it's sometimes a little bit more difficult. But generally, I'm troubleshooting stuff on SCSI drives. If I have a SATA drive problem, or I even think a SATA drive is causing a problem, I just replace it. I generally don't get the large size, so they're not that expensive.
Yeah, I haven't done much with SATA. Most of my machines are still IDE, and that's kind of the way I go. If IDE drives are so cheap that if I even suspect it's going bad, you know, I just shelf it and get a new one.
All right. Do you have any favorite brands for hard drives?
I've always had really good luck with Maxtor. I don't know. I think that hard drives are kind of one of those, everybody's got a favorite and nobody agrees, has been my experience. But I'm a big fan of Maxtor. How about you?
Yeah, I've actually been a fan of Maxtor for quite a while. There was a time when I would basically refuse to use Seagate. But over the past couple of years, I think most of the manufacturers are really about the same. They have about the same failure rate no matter which brand you use. What it really comes down to is which, if you want to drive with the latest and greatest technology, like Seagate right now I think is the only manufacturer for 750 gig SATA drives. So if you want a 750, you got to go with Seagate. But as the other manufacturers catch up, for the most part they're all going to be the same. Okay, now let's talk about RAID. Gek, what's RAID?
RAID is redundant array of independent disks or drives. I don't remember which. And it's basically, it's different standards for either keeping your data redundant or striping drives together so that you end up getting, you know, a larger drive. It looks like a larger drive to the operating system. Or, you know, parity. You can use it for parity on a stripe also. Why don't you tell us the different RAID numbers and what they mean?
Well, actually, before I do that, let me go over a little bit of why you might want to use RAID, because the numbers don't make sense without that. Basically, the main reason why you want to use RAID is it's not a form of backup or anything like that. It just protects against a drive failure. So if you have, as we all know, hard drives fail, and the idea is if you're running a server, it's, especially if you're making money with a server, it's much better to have as much uptime as possible on that server as you can manage. And having RAID is one of the ways you can do that. From just being a system admin, it's much more convenient when a drive fails that your system is up and running, it's not a fire that you have to take care of right now, you can replace the drive when you get to it over the next hour or two. That's the main benefit for RAID, is just the protection from drive loss. The different levels of RAID, you have protection against one drive loss, or you have protection against a few drives that you can lose and still keep the system up and running. Now, for the RAID levels, the basic ones that, as far as I know, all hardware RAID controllers support are 0 and 1. 0 is just striping, and it's basically like gluing two hard drives together. So if you have two 100 gig drives, when your system looks at it, it'll look like a single 200 gig drive. It doesn't give you any protection at all. The only reason why you would ever really want to use that is it makes reads and writes quite a bit faster. Because as an example, if you're writing a 100 meg file, instead of having one drive trying to write the entire file to the disk, you now have two drives that can write, each one writes half of the bits to the drive, so you can write it twice as fast. The other one, RAID 1, is mirroring. So in that case, you have two drives that are exact copies of each other on the bit level. So if you have two 100 gig drives, your system only sees one of them, or sees it as one drive. The benefit there is you can lose one drive, and you can still have your system up and running. If it's a most hardware RAID controllers now support hot plugging if your hard drive support it. So you can actually replace the drive, rebuild a mirror, and never have to take your system down. There are a number of other RAID levels. A lot of them are proprietary, but the other two major ones are RAID 5, which is you can think of it as a kind of the combination of the benefits for 1 and 0. If you, first of all, it requires at least 3 drives, and you basically take, in a 3-drive configuration, a third of each drive is only used for parity, so that if you lose a drive, you can access the data or rebuild that drive from some of the information that is stored on the other remaining drives. That's a copy of what is on the drive that has failed. So in the case of 100 gig drives, if you have 3 of them, you have 300 gigs total storage, but what your system will see is 200 gigs because you're only getting 2/3 of each of the drives. So the way that RAID 5 works is even if you have 5 drives or 10 drives, you're always going to give up one drive's worth of space to the parity that gets spread across each of the drives. Again, the benefit there is you can lose a drive, and you can also smash the drives together, so you get a lot more storage that you can use. The other one, which is of all the ones that are really useful, is probably the most expensive, is RAID 10. And the reason why it's expensive is you're, like RAID 5, you're going to lose some of the drives, usable drive space. In the case of RAID 10, you're going to lose 50% of it. So you have to have an even number of drives. And it is a perfect combination of RAID 0 and RAID 1. If you have 6 drives, for example, each pair is mirrored. So you end up with basically 3 mirrors. Then where the RAID 0 comes in, is it stripes all three of those mirrors together. So if you have six 100 gig drives, you only have 300 gigs of usable space. The big benefit there is it for disk access, it's actually faster than RAID 5, and it protects against the loss of more drives. Depending on which drives they are, you could lose 50% of your hard drives, and the system would still be up and running. You would still have access to all the data. RAID 10 is also known, depending on what controller it is, because there's different ways to combine the RAID 1 and RAID 0. RAID 10 is also known as 1 plus 0 or 0 plus 1. It really depends on which part happens first, the mirroring or the striping. Gek, when it comes to SCSI or SATA RAID controllers, do you have any particular brands that you like?
I haven't really done much with SATA RAID controllers, but for SCSI, I've always been a big fan of Adaptec. They're a little more expensive, especially when you get into the really, really nice Adaptec cards. But I've never had one go bad in such a way that it totally ruined the drives that were attached to it. I've had really good luck with them, where if the controller goes bad, even if it takes out a drive with it, I can take the same make and model card, pop it in, and it'll work, and I can recover the data off the drives.
Yeah, I've actually been burned by Adaptec a couple of times on SCSI stuff, so much so that I try to avoid them if I can. Right now, my favorite SCSI RAID cards are either LSI, a chipset that's LSI, because there's a number of manufacturers that make them. Nice thing is that the operating system manufacturers basically only have to have one driver. Say they have 10 different models of RAID card. The one driver works across all of them. The more expensive cards, of course, you have more features, but you just have one driver to deal with. They also have some really good utilities for Linux so that you can manage the RAID card with the system up and running just from a command line. On the SATA side of the house, I've always been a big fan of Threeware. Threeware is the only true SATA RAID card manufacturer out there. Adaptec has them. Promise makes some. But I've always felt that Threeware is much better. I've always got better performance, and I've never had an issue with Threeware cards. Plus the fact that they make cards now that you can plug in up to 16 drives into. And that's just amazing to me. If you need a file server, you go out, you get 16 750 gig drives, plug them into a Threeware card, and you're off and running, and you have just ridiculous amounts of storage. Okay, let's move on to network hardware. Since this is on the server side, I guess we're just talking about network cards. Gek, what can you tell us about network cards?
I have always been a fan of Intel cards. They're not the cheapest, but they definitely work. Network cards, when you think about it, you have to consider what kind of speed you're going to need for the server. And generally, these days, you're talking about either 100 megabit or gigabit. And in my mind, if you can afford gigabit, you should get it. There's no reason to not expect to be using, you know, gigabit in the next few years. I think as the internet grows, as technology grows, people are just going to expect you to have that kind of bandwidth, so you might as well plan for it.
Yeah, I'd have to agree on the Intel cards, especially on some of the higher-end ones. And on the higher-end ones, I'm talking like a $30 card or at most like a $40 card. They actually have onboard processors that can do some of the TCP/IP checksums. Normally your OS would take care of that, but if you can offload it onto the network card, why not do it? I mean, it makes perfect sense to do it there, and that frees up your CPU and free cycles on your system to take care of it. So I've always gotten really good performance out of Intel cards, and I've never had one go bad. I also agree on the gigabit. You might as well go ahead and get a gigabit. Even if you're not using it in your file server right now or your mail server right now, it's definitely something you want to look at later on down the road. And for the most part, you can take your network card and keep it with your upgrade. So if you replace the motherboard or you upgrade to a completely new system, you can take your PCI network card with you, and you know, you get much more value out of it that way. one of the things to look at when you're designing a server is the size, especially if you're going to have this hosted somewhere. They're going to charge you depending on the size of your server, so you want to get it as small as possible. Right now, the standard is a 1U. The problem with 1U servers, which are roughly an inch and a half tall, is that you don't have much space to put any kind of PCI cards in. At most, you might be able to fit two cards in. But if you need a lot of interfaces, like you're doing a firewall, or you want a back-end file server for your web servers or your mail servers, is you need a lot more ports. And just about every card manufacturer out there at least makes dual port network cards, so it's basically two network cards that fit in one PCI slot. It's kind of all smooshed together onto one card. And on the higher end, some manufacturers even have quad cards, so you have four usable network ports in one PCI slot. There's some performance degradation on that, but not enough that would be noticeable in most real-world environments.
One of the other things that you can consider with network cards is what I like to do, and I've done this everywhere I worked, is I use one interface exclusively for maintenance, backups, monitoring, and that's it, nothing else. And then I use another interface that's the one that actually talks to either the public out to the internet, or if I'm just talking to other servers, I have one network that's just for my servers, and then another one that I use as my maintenance network. I like doing that just because if I'm doing backups, I don't want my backups to be fighting users for bandwidth on the same network card. I want the backups to have as much bandwidth as they can.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I've even heard of some places that have dedicated backup networks. So you would have a management interface, a public interface, and then a dedicated backup interface. And that's actually really good when we were talking about the gig interfaces, the gig network cards. That's the number one place to use it, is on the backup interface. You want those backups to be able to push as much bandwidth as possible so the backup works as quickly as it can. Now for this episode's moment of SAC. Physical security. Gek, take it away.
Okay. One of the things that you really do want to pay attention to is the physical conditions of your box. You need to be aware of what things are typically connected to it and what things aren't. One of the concerns that people have is keyloggers. Keyloggers are dirt cheap. They are not always obvious. You can buy, there's a $100 keylogger that comes with some tape so that you can actually tape up the end of the, like, where your keyboard plugs into the computer. You attach the keylogger, tape it up, and you can make it look like it's supposed to be there, like there's no keylogger, there's nothing wrong. And if somebody puts that on your computer, then they walk away, they come back 2 weeks later, it's recorded all of your keystrokes for the past 2 weeks, they've got who knows what, user account names, passwords, credit card numbers, social security numbers, letters that you wrote to friends or family, or maybe financial documents. It depends on what you've been typing. That's something that you want to watch out for. Obviously, you can't go and look behind your computer every time you go to use it, but if you take care of your machine and you put it in such a way that it would be hard to put that on, unnoticed, that's something you want to look into. And one of the things that people have developed for keyloggers and other physical security concerns are cages, where you can basically lock a PC into a box or just a cage and have it so that the wires come out the back. And you can pretty much protect the system pretty well. There's always going to be ways around that. You can certainly do things outside of the box that'll allow you to capture data coming off the box across the network. And so what you have to do when it comes to physical security, for me, I always sit down and actually say, how much do I care about what's on this box? Is it something I value enough that I need to make sure nobody can get to it? Or is it something where it would be inconvenient for somebody to access the data, but it's not going to kill me? I do think that you have to give it some thought. It really is something that people overlook, and there's a reason why some of the hosting companies that provide physical security, charge astronomical rates because it's not something that's easy to accomplish. And if you can do it, it's valuable. It's valuable to a lot of people. What do you usually do for physical security?
Well, I pretty much do the same thing. I try and figure out exactly what kind of data is going to be on the box and how I'm going to be accessing it. But one thing I'm always sure of is I make sure that I can trust where I'm going to be physically locating the box, whether it's in my server closet or it's at a data center. I have to be able to trust the people that are there. You know, they need access so they can help me remotely. You know, if I have a box die, I need them to cable it up, try rebooting it. I need them to have access to it. But I also want to be able to have a certain amount of trust that they're not going to take my box down and copy all the hard drives and keep all that data or put all that data up on eBay or whatever. So you have to think quite a bit about physical security. You can get lockable cases so that when you're sending your server out to a data center, they can't break into the box and take the hard drives out without actually breaking the case. But and again, if somebody has access to your box, they can do anything they want with that box. They can own that box with all of the data that's on it. So for most of us, we can't afford to have it in a place that really cares that much about physical security, or you're even just, you know, renting a server where you don't control the hardware at all. But it is definitely something you want to think about, because it is something that is often overlooked, and people have been bitten by it. You know, there was one case I read about where a guy was running an IRC server, and somebody that was one of the users of the server was upset that he kept getting banned from the server no matter what IP he came from. Of course, he was stupid and always used the same username, but that's a different story. He tracked down what data center the IRC server was in, arranged a tour, was able to see the server name actually labeled on the server, and took out a bottle of water and sprayed it in the CD drive, taking the server down for quite a few hours while they were trying to dry it out. Things like that can happen, so you have to think about what can you do to try and prevent that. And really, the most anybody can do these days is just put it in a data center where you feel comfortable with the people there, that they're actually going to be monitoring any other customers that physically have access to where your box is stored. For show notes or other details, please visit our website at runyourownserver.org. If you would like to send us feedback or have a question you'd like us to answer on the show, please send an email to podcast@runyourownserver.org. The intro music, I Like Caffeine, is by Tom Cody. This song, Down the Road, is by Rob Koslow. Please visit our website for links to their websites. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. Please visit our website for more details.